Blog Talk Radio.
The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Stuart Alexander, and once again, I would like to welcome my listeners to Left Turn with Stuart Alexander. I'm getting very familiar with using that new title that we have for the show, Left Turn with Stuart Alexander. Previously, we were the Socialist Insight, but I like the new direction that we have taken with this new title, Left Turn, because we are talking to many of our listeners who understand the policies and the direction of the left and the right, and we realize that the right is all about capitalism, and when we look at the left is about working people, working class issues. And today we have Al Suarez. He's joining our program once again. We're going to be talking about some pretty hot issues of the looming global economic crisis, and the name of our show today is Signs That Capitalism is Failing Worldwide Since 9/11. And Al, thanks for joining the program once again.
And thanks for having me. And while you were saying that about the left, I was thinking about Bernie Sanders. We were talking about him last time. I mean, these so-called socialists put out this quote for Bernie Sanders talking about, you know, the middle class and, you know, we got to focus on the middle class and we got to make reforms and this or that. And I finally just had to leave Cotton, like, look, you guys are a bunch of bourgeois reformists, and this guy is not a real socialist, and you should be focusing on the working class and on the poor.
For the record, let me just say this. For the record, Bernie Sanders is not a socialist. He's a reformist. Bernie Sanders is all about the issues that keep the Democratic Party in the position that they're in right now, where they're ruling in Congress, where they're bringing people from the left, taking them to the middle. Bernie Sanders does not represent the working class people of this country. He is nothing more than just a lot of talk.
Pardon me? I was there in Vermont. He never once showed up on camp. Palladino showed up to an Occupy event, the other senator from Vermont. But Sanders never showed up. So he only supported us in words, not in action. And he just voted along with the genocide in Gaza.
He goes along with this genocide that's taking place, as you mentioned, in Gaza. He has supported the war efforts and funding there in Afghanistan, in Iraq. He has supported, you know, he supports the troops. He supports sending troops abroad, you know, to fight these dirty wars. I mean, this is not what a socialist, from the type of leadership that I'm expecting from a socialist. I don't expect to see that type of representation in Washington.
And don't get me started on Elizabeth Warren.
We don't even want to go there.
She supports the war with Iran.
Otherwise, we're going to be talking this whole show about the phony socialist.
Yeah, she's to the right of some Republicans. Some Republicans sanctions against Iran. She actually said things in favor of a war against Iran. So on the foreign front, she's basically fascistic.
No, I don't support her at all. Al, I'm going to get to our program today. We're talking about capitalism, signs that capitalism is failing since 9/11. It's failing worldwide since 9/11. Now, we have seen, when you look across the globe, I mean, we have had signs that a economic collapse has been taking place all the way from the 70s. We can go all the way back to 1978 and 79 when Jimmy Carter was in office, and we could see that the Reagan camp, when he was running as a candidate for president, he was saying how he was going to turn the economy around, how he was going to create jobs, much of the same nonsense that you heard from Obama. And at the time, the economy was in a severe decline. In addition to what was taking place in the economy, we could see that you had the 50 hostages that were there in Iran. So people were expecting for Reagan to create some type of a miracle, just like people were expecting for Obama to create a miracle. Subsequently, we didn't get a miracle from Reagan, but what people refer to that the policies that he was introducing on his platform, people were already, before he was elected into office, people were already saying Reaganomics. Now, many people can remember that term, Reaganomics. What was happening was many of his advisors, they were putting out information about what they were going to do to turn around the economy, but it had no concrete basis of how they would achieve that. Now, what we saw, Al, what to start taking place at the beginning of his administration, we saw many Ponzi schemes that has gone over for the last 25 years. Actually, ever since 1980 until today, well over 30 years. Al, my question to you is that when we look at the situation that we have today, because the worldwide, which we're going to discuss later, the whole global economy, Al, is on the verge of a collapse. We have all the experts, even experts representing the entire world banking system, they are telling us there are signs that the economy, the global economy, is going to collapse. But we're not hearing this. But Al, my question is, leading up until 2001, when we saw 9/11, now this is etched in everyone's minds that, you know, we were threatened by terrorists, but actually something was taking place that was much more ominous before that. The economy was already collapsing. Were we already in a position where the economy was going to collapse 20 years before 9/11 even took place, Al?
Well, before we get into that, I just wanted to mention that we had an exception, and this may change, where more socialists could win with Kashama Sawant's victory in Seattle. But we have to be careful about, because there's some people that are members of Socialist Alternative who talk about, you know, radical reform, and there's a debate there on whether or not that's a contradiction. Again, we shouldn't be afraid whether we're in city council, the Senate, wherever, in saying what we want, and that is a revolution. I think that's what the workers and the people in this country want. You know, they want a revolutionary change. They don't want reform anymore because reform's not working. And you mentioned Ronald Reagan. I just wanted to read this quote from the late James Garner, who was a great actor and activist. He said, "Ronald Reagan wasn't qualified to be governor, let alone president. I was vice president of the Screen Actors Guild when he was its president. Ronnie never had an original thought. We had to tell him what to say. That's no way to run a union, let alone a country." So, you know, when Reagan was governor of California, for example, he worked with the NRA to try to ban blacks from having guns because they were afraid of the Black Panther movement. And I think that Herbert Walker Bush, Reagan's vice president, really told Reagan what he had to do. And I think that Bush Jr., who was, you know, dumber than his father, had Cheney sent in from his father, who used to work with Bush Sr., to tell basically George W. Bush what to do. But either way, there's a shadow government.
Right. So what I'm saying is, since over the last 34 years, and I'm going all the way back to 1980, before 9/11, I mean, I can see that there were already signs that the collapse was already in the making. And, of course, we saw the collapse that took place in 2008. I see one that's already, it's already on the horizon. But in your opinion and what you have seen, can you see where it's a pattern that has been taking place over the last 3 decades?
Well, let me give you an example. When somebody talks about fixing capitalism, you shouldn't really support what that person's saying. They might be well-intentioned, but capitalism cannot be fixed. Capitalism can only be reformed. You know, capitalism itself is a cancerous disease on the poor and working class of the country, and this disease must be cured. And it can't be cured with a Band-Aid, with reform here or there. So at once every couple decades, there's always an economic crisis or even a recession or depression in some levels. And that's because capitalism itself doesn't work. It can't be fixed. It has to be replaced with a new system, and we know the system is socialism, which is a more egalitarian, more just, and more humane system for the society. And there are remnants of socialism within our own society, Social Security, Medicaid, minimum wage. These are all acquired by the struggle of socialists and radicals, not by FDR reform. They had to pressure FDR to do that. And now they're trying to bring that back. And, you know, in Europe, for example, they're more socialistic. They have more social programs. But still, they haven't gone far enough. What we need is a society that has radical change, and that can only come about with revolutionary process.
You know, some of the things I'm looking at when we look at, and of course we're going to get into many of the signs that are taking place, but let's look at world debt for just a minute. If you look at the world banking, where we have central banks throughout the world, and we can see that many countries are trying to break away even from the central banks, because the central banks basically, they create money out of nothing, and they loan money to governments. And after they loan the money to governments, then they require that money to be paid back with interest. If you look at the global debt, now it exceeds $100 trillion. When we think about the U.S. debt, and we think that we're right at $18 trillion, here you look at the total global debt of the world, it exceeds $100 trillion. And people say, well, who is it owed to? Well, it's owed to private banks. And
the
banks loan money. They loan money to governments like the U.S. and like to the U.K. and to the Ukraine and to Russia and to China. But the money is still owed, money that has been loaned to governments for social services, for building economies, and this money is owed back. When you look at
the federal government owes money to Social Security, and you had Obama,
when you look at the
to bring up to the Republicans that he wanted to cut Social Security.
When you look at the total debt worldwide, that's at an average of $15,000 that's owed by every man, woman, and child worldwide. If you look at the debt here in this country, Al, that's $58,000. $58,000 that's owed by every man, woman, and child. As soon as a child is born in this country, they already owe $58,000 just to pay back the debt. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, much of what we have seen since 9/11, we have been on a crusade in this country, a crusade for war, to invade countries, to overthrow nations. But basically, you know, we have been, when you look at the history of this country, it didn't just start after 9/11. It started right after the First Continental Congress, because we have been involved in more than 300 conflicts and wars and incursions ever since that Congress met and formed this government. Now, Al, part of what I'm looking at here is when I'm looking at, you know, 9/11, we have been involved in Iraq. We have been involved in Afghanistan, which we're still involved in Afghanistan. Now we're involved in Ukraine. Could you share a little bit about our involvement there in the Ukraine, Al?
Yeah, just before I get into that, I wanted to give the perfect example of an American leader who warned us about the dangers of the banks. One of my favorite Lincoln quotes is, I have the Confederates to the south and the bankers to the north. For my nation, I fear more the bankers. And if you look at the inflation in Venezuela, what these so-called peaceful protesters are complaining about in Venezuela, who controls the food companies in Venezuela? The opposition, right? The bourgeoisie.
Mm-hmm.
they control the food companies, therefore they control the prices of food. So you have people essentially from the former ruling class in Venezuela who are complaining about problems they're creating. So it's an intentional sabotage of the Venezuelan economy to use as a pretext to go after the socialist government there, which is a very popular government who's won several elections over the past decade, including Maduro has won elections after the death of Chavez. So when you're talking about banks and inflation, they have a reason for doing what they're doing. And they let their buddies know before something major happens so they can get out of there and benefit off it, you know, off an insurance policy or whatever. So, you know, when the Depression happened in the United States, a lot of, you know, upper class people suffered when they invested in Wall Street and lost all their money and their pensions. But there was a small group of elites that knew before what was going to happen and were able to benefit from it and get the money out in time. So your question
right.
about Ukraine?
Right.
Yeah, the Ukraine, the perfect example of
I'm talking about
flag.
U.S. involvement even in countries like the Ukraine because what
we're
doing.
I'll tell you a little bit about that.
Talk about the history of how we financed the overthrow of a government, legitimate government.
Not only did the United States, $1 billion that they gave to the Slova Party?
$5 billion.
Known as the National Socialist Party, which in other words is a Nazi party. So these are fascists and neo-Nazis that took over in Kiev. Groups that, you know, like right sector militia that were condemned as fascist by the European Union, as early as last year. And now the European Union and the United States embraces them because they're using them as pawns against Russia, obviously. But, not only the money and the training and the arms that are sent to the Western Ukrainians to go in and try to invade Eastern Ukraine, which are themselves
mm-hmm.
committing massacres against ethnic Russians in Eastern Ukraine, much in the Israeli fashion like they did in Gaza. So it's not just a question of that, but I think you had a recent event in Ukraine, or what's called Nova Russa, which is the new autonomous government in eastern Ukraine. In that region, what's the name? Poroshenko, the new president of Ukraine, a billionaire, he ordered that plane, the Malaysian Airlines, to divert and to go over basically a war zone. So whether or not the plane was shot down, it was a setup because the government ordered the plane to take that route. And also, there's no evidence that Eastern Ukrainians have access to weapons that could reach a commercial airline. The only people that have weapons like that are the ones in Kiev, in Western Ukraine.
Right.
So I think this was a total setup. I think it was a false flag, and I think it's used to try to get more people to back the massacres again and the invasion of the eastern Ukrainians. So it's just another example of a false flag.
Let me ask you, and I'm going to get ahead of myself, do you think 9/11, what happened to the Twin Towers, you think that was a false flag?
Well, who benefited? You know, it's, how do you say it in Latin, cui bono, who benefits, right? Whenever there's a conspiracy or a tragedy and there's, you know, something fishy about it, you've
right.
got to see, you know, what are the consequences of that, what happened after it, who benefited from it. So, you know, as any investigator would think. So, there was people that had, you know, insurance out on the Twin Towers, their own part of the Twin Towers, and they had
right.
got that money just, weeks before the attacks on the Twin Towers. So they
right.
were able to benefit from those towers collapsing. There was, you know, hundreds
They had taken out insurance
of
policies weeks before, right?
Right, exactly. And there was hundreds if not thousands of businessmen, you know, middle class, upper middle class, that suffered from losing their offices at Twin Towers. But again, the top guys, the elites, they benefited. And they knew what was
right.
going on. There was countless intelligence agencies that warned the United States government. I believe Bulgaria, Argentina, Israel, there were so many different intelligence agencies that was warning the United States government that was going to be attacked that day on the Twin Towers. And in the weekend before the attack, there was the building was shut down and cleaned out, and that's
right.
when they could have planted the dynamite, because Building 3 was completely intact. That was
right.
probably the control tower.
What happened to Building 7? What happened to Building 7?
Yeah, Building 7, the control tower for demolition, the thing was that the BBC was reporting live in front of Building 7, which was completely intact,
right.
Saying that it had collapsed, and it hadn't collapsed yet. So they got the information a little too early,
they were report,
right?
You, they were in front of the tower? I mean, they were in front of Building 7?
Look this up.
Yeah, no. I didn't know they were right in front.
You can see in the background that it's completely intact, Building 7. And they're reporting on its collapse. And you can't say that they got the wrong information, because it collapsed a few minutes later, and there wasn't a single debris on top of that building. Also, you've had towers in countless countries. In Madrid, you had this giant tower that was on fire for several hours, never collapsed. So there's been towers that were made in a similar fashion to the Twin Towers that they've been on fire and never collapsed the way they collapsed. So did those planes fall into those towers? Yes. But at the same time, for those buildings to collapse the way they did scientifically and with the laws of physics and gravity, it was impossible that they fell, and countless of scientists have backed this up, that they fell the way they fall without a demolition. And the Pentagon's case is even more obvious. I mean, the missile hit in the renovated part of the Pentagon where casualties were minimal. So, you know, did the terrorists know in the plane to hit that exact spot in the Pentagon where it was renovated, where there was the least amount of employees? And not only that, the size of the hole in the Pentagon had to have been a missile. I mean, the government...
Have they ever produced any type of footage showing a plane flying into the building?
Yeah, you think of all the cameras in D.C., even at that time, that they would have footage of that, and they were confiscated.
Oh, they had a gazillion cameras.
Right, and there was some footage that still got out that showed what looked like a small missile, probably launched by the government.
Not to mention the Pentagon has constant air patrol, constant.
Right, and every single member of the Kennedy administration, except for McNamara, I believe he was number three, up there, like number two or number three in the administration. Every single member of the Kennedy cabinet signed on to the false flag to get the United States behind an invasion of Cuba. You know this, right? The plan was to bring a CIA plane and to fly it out from Miami and to make it look like it was shot down over by Havana and to really, you know, let the plane land in Puerto Rico and make it look like there was a crash. So they had a similar operation planned back in the 60s, and it came very close to being passed. So the false flag is nothing new.
Right. So when we look at false flags, I mean, basically, when we talk about the Ukraine false flag, the Malaysian airline, MH17, crashed. Now they're all of a sudden trying to say, we know who done it. You know, we already got the whodunits out there.
By the way, whoever said Bin Laden was on the CIA table.
Not even one day after the crash, they have already completed the investigations. They got the whodunits, and they're ready to declare war. So,
let me ask you another
is this another false flag?
Right. And do you know that Bin Laden? Whoever says that Bin Laden, that everybody, you know, people say, oh, everybody knows Bin Laden was on the payroll in the '80s, you know, to fight the Russians, and that was it. But no, that's not true. Up until 2001, there's evidence showing that Bin Laden continued to be on the CIA payroll. He was used to send Mujahideen into China because China borders Afghanistan. So they were still using the Mujahideen and Bin Laden as their asset for the CIA up until 2001. So this also makes him, you know, the scapegoat, you know, because Oswald was working for the FBI. They said so they like to use agents and then use them as scapegoats, you know, when they're easy to use as the boogeyman whenever they commit their, you know, plans, their false flags.
So. Al, we can see it's a lot of false flags, and we can see how banks, how they use governments is one thing I just want to read, and I wish I had actually put down exactly who had written it, but it says, the United States fought the American Revolution primarily over King George III's Currency Act, which forced the colonists to conduct their business only using printed money, printed banknotes borrowed from the Bank of England at interest. After the Revolution, the United States adopted a radically different economic system in which the government issued its own value-based money so that private banks like the Bank of England were not siphoning off the wealth of the people through interest-bearing banknotes. But bankers are nothing if not dedicated to their schemes to acquire your wealth, and know full well how easy it is to corrupt a nation's leader. One year after Mayor Armchel Rockchell had uttered his infamous, "Let me issue and control a nation's money, and I care not who makes the laws. The bankers succeeded in setting up a new private central bank called the First Bank of the United States, largely through the efforts of the Rothschilds. What do you think?
Yeah, that sounds accurate. You're talking about the top bank elites. That's what they're trying to do, the capitalists in general. They're trying to benefit themselves. And I just want to put this out there. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm a conspiracy analyst, because the difference is the conspiracy theorists tend to pick and choose. Yeah, there is. They tend to pick and choose to whatever benefits their theory. People like Alex Jones. What I do is analyze the facts, and then you can draw the conclusions
right
from there.
And as I mentioned, when you look at what I had mentioned before, when they set up the First Bank of the United States, the person that they had to set it up, their chief emissary there with the Continental Congress, was Alexander Hamilton.
Oh, yeah.
So
Hamilton
basically,
was a traitor.
Pardon me?
Hamilton was a traitor. He was an economic traitor, absolutely.
Yeah,
he changed
right
the financial system of the United States to be dependent on their former enemies at the time, the British. And then
that,
the United
that
States
was
took on the role of the British Empire, only be calling it, you know, the American
right, that,
democracy.
That was the first effort to give the whole banking system of this country over to private banks. In 1913, Congress, through legislation, turned over the entire banking system to the Federal Reserve. Now, much of this, if you look at the way it ties in, is banks, let's face it, Al, they make money through wars. They make money through conflicts. Because
well, yeah, they also finance coups against against their own government.
Banks finance both sides. They finance
both sides in conflicts all the time. Yeah, they
right
did that, and they ran Iraq war and all that.
Now, very interesting, when they finance both sides, they finance the victor, and they also finance the vanquished. The ones that lose,
yeah,
they also finance
program
them too. And in addition to that, once they finance them, then they require the victor to take care of reparations. People don't understand how the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, those two wars have already, the cost, banks look at the future costs, the present costs and future costs of those wars, $6 trillion and counting just for the U.S. That's monies that we had to pay in reparations to those countries.
Here's two examples. The oil for food program. After Saddam Hussein was defeated in the first Persian Gulf War, without an invasion of Iraq, when he was defeated in Kuwait, which used to be part of Iraq, was invented by the British to get more oil. But, you know, when the Kuwaitis were taking too much Iraqi oil and he was trying to retake Kuwait, there was Persian Gulf War in the 90s, and then, you know, they had the oil food program. And the oil food program was a very corrupt system, a very corrupt program, and, you know, a million children died because of the sanctions. And, you know, so that's kind of, you know, making the defeated pay reparations, which had terrible consequences, much like the Treaty of Versailles. If you look
right
at the Treaty of Versailles at the end of World War One, that was essentially punishing those who defeated the Germans. And therefore, it helped the conditions come about for a counter-revolution. And essentially, the fascists, instead of the socialists, prevailed. And eventually, World War II came about. Before World War II came about, there was a lot of sympathy for the fascists in the United States. As a matter of fact, Americans that came back after fighting the fascists in Spain in the Civil War, their national brigades, a lot of them lost their citizenship and were sent to jail. The exception being Ernest Hemingway, because he was a famous writer. And he did happen to fight fascists, but because he was famous, he was exempted from that. But he was very aware that a lot of his comrades coming back to the United States and other nations were persecuted. George Orwell was another exception, because a lot of the British people that returned to their country that survived the Spanish Civil War were persecuted. But because Orwell was a famous writer, he was also an exception. And thanks to that, we know from literature of Orwell and Hemingway and others what really went down in fighting those fascists. And, of course, the United States at the time was neutral. It wasn't until much later on, out of loyalty to the Japanese, right, the German treaty with the Japanese, that after Pearl Harbor, the Germans declared war on the United States. That changed public opinion. And I don't think Pearl Harbor was false flag. I think it was more negligence, kind of like what happened in Boston. I think that, for the Boston bombing. So it was clear negligence because they let
it
be vulnerable so that it would change public opinion and be attacked by the Japanese, because the Japanese did have an embargo.
Negligent as in we neglected to do something? Because we
Absolutely.
Clearly
it
knew
we already knew about the Japanese plans.
We already knew about the Japanese plans 2 months in advance.
Yes. I know.
So I mean, you know, like
is.
Negligent as in, like you just want to neglect to take action. You know,
yes, and the reason why the neglect
certainly
to take action
an
to
accident.
Defend Pearl Harbor was to change public opinion, because the very next day a million American servicemen volunteered to join World War II.
Right. Because you have to realize that we were already pushing for war. We were already pushing for war, but, you know, America at the time,
well,
after
that,
coming out of World War
One,
they still wanted to remain isolationists. After what happened to Pearl Harbor, that was like 9/11. Here in California, you know, talking about Pearl Harbor, you know, and I think that was a false flag also. But here in California, after what happened to the Twin Towers, you went block after block, miles and miles, and flags were flying everywhere. People, I mean, here are people that almost as old as me, ready to take up arms and go to war.
I know, but what's your definition of a false flag then?
My definition is when an event is created and it's a false flag to the people of this country, the working people, the ones that are going to actually go and give their blood to fight these dirty wars. That's the false flag that actually goes out to the people.
Through the mainstream media. Yeah. So it doesn't mean the Japanese were a rogue group, and then that the government had to support them, and that rogue group were influenced by the CIA. It doesn't mean that, right?
Well, let's look at it. If the U.S., having knowledge, even, and they had mainstream media then, it was radio, and they had newsprint, you know, but it was, let's face it, it was owned by the wealthy elite of the country at the time. It was owned by the bankers at the time. But we could have been prepared. People could have been notified that this was taking place, but they weren't. It was kept silent until the attack took place. Like what you were mentioning about what happened.
There were literally Japanese ambassadors at the White House about to meet the president to negotiate the terms for ending the embargo against Japan when the news came in that there was an aerial assault on Pearl Harbor, which was not part of the United States. I mean, it was a U.S. base, but Hawaii was not part of the United States yet. So you're saying that was a maneuver by the Japanese to send those
No, no. What I'm saying is information.
Yeah.
Like when you look at the mainstream media today, we withhold information so that this government can get the end results that they desire. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about withholding information. Al, when you withhold information, that's basically it's an element of propaganda, because you withhold information and then you tell people what you want them to hear. That's propaganda.
But if somebody's conspiring and orchestrating to commit an act, right, and another person is making sure the conditions for the act is there by misinformation, withholding information, and letting an opposing force come and do that act, I guess those are two different types of false flags, because I was under the impression that false flag was just, you know, you're actually
firing. There's more than just one. You know, when I say false flags, I mean, it's not just one definition for it.
Right.
Right. Because we can see that, you know, you provide certain information, but it directs the minds of people to want to move in a certain direction. And usually the direction is a direction of war or further conflict. Al, I'm just going to take a very quick break here. I just want to mention once again we have Al Suarez. He's joining the program today on Left Turn with Stuart Alexander. And today we're talking about signs that capitalism is failing worldwide since 9/11. And Al, again, I want to thank you for joining the program today.
Thank you. I mean, feel free to put the number out, too, in case anybody has any questions for me or for you.
Right. And people can always call in. I'm glad you mentioned that. They can always call in to 718-664-6436. That's 718-664-6436. And so anyway, Al, that's when I say false flag, I'm talking about things that actually – information is put out there to the public. And we see it, Al, it's on both sides. You know, the information you get, the Russians putting out their information, and I'm not supportive of, you know, Putin. You know, I'm not supportive of Obama. But the thing is, right. You have to realize these people make it in these positions because they're the ones that control both sides, which are the banks.
If the Russians and the Indians and the Chinese and, you know, BRICS and Brazil and all those guys, you know, make their own banking system, again, they're capitalists. You know, they're making another type of capitalism. So,
right.
You know, that's not going to solve the problem either. I mean,
no.
They might be a more humane type of capitalism. I mean, the Chinese have capitalism within their system. I mean, it's better than the United States. They have over a billion people and they're still functioning. They give credit for that. But, you know, they still have overpopulation issues, one-child policy, which I feel is an issue of survival, not morality, when it comes to the Chinese. India has a huge population right now as well. But the other day, I was looking at this video in China, and you had these people on, I guess it would be a subway, and they were trying to enter the train, and there was literally, like, soldiers, and they were pushing people in the train. The people were going willingly, it appeared, into the train, and they were stuffing them into the train. I don't know how people can travel like that. I would have insisted on waiting for the next train. But they were all stuffed in there, and I guess that's a population issue. So, you know, different cultures, they have different problems, different things they have to deal with to survive. But, yeah, we need a change of the global system as a whole. It's not just replacing one form of capitalism with another or one form of fascism with another, which was like after World War II. What we need is a change altogether.
Well, I agree with
you. Latin America.
I agree with you what you're saying, that we do need a change.
Yeah, and it's not an impossible dream because in Latin America they're doing it already. You know, if the Latin Americans can do it, then they can get rid of U.S. bases and they can unite and make a more social and progressive society and unite their economies and whatnot, then other nations of the world can do it as well. They tried to make the African Union, and instead they destroyed Libya. But there's still a possibility later on they can do that.
And, Al, you know, I'm just going to focus a little bit about what is taking place, because I think what is taking place with this economy, because what happened in 2008, we have never recovered from that recession, and I think what is going to take place within the next year to a year and a half from now is going to make 2008 just look like a precursor, because what we see, and I'm just looking at some information that was written by Michael Snyder on the economic collapse, and he says, let me see. He mentioned, so it doesn't really matter too much whether the short-term economic numbers go up or a little bit, go up a little bit or down a little bit. The whole system is an inherently flawed Ponzi scheme that will inevitably collapse under its own weight. But when we see that the way that the U.S. debt and the world debt is climbing, as I meant to mention a few minutes ago, the amount of the debt globally has soared more than 40% to $100 trillion since the first signs of the financial crisis, as governments borrowed to pull their economies out of recession, and companies took advantage of record low interest rates, according to the Bank for International Settlements. Now, this is very important when you consider the way that debt is just increasing. And I see, Al, when people – I'm in the automobile business, and people could talk about that they expect automobile loans at 1.9%, 2.9% interest on new cars, or 0%. And when people are buying homes and they still see these ridiculously low interest rates, I remember when you were buying homes back in the late 70s, interest rates for buying a home was like close to 15%. That's what the interest rates were. And now people are expecting like 5% and 6% on home loans and even lower. But Al, this money that we see is being subsidized by the banks. We see it being subsidized by the international banks, by the Federal Reserve. But, Al, when you look at this and you look at the mess that countries are placing themselves in, they're setting themselves up for the next collapse that's going to take place. Now, Al, you know, some of the things that I just want to mention, I'm going to let you comment on these. We say this 20 signs that the global economic crisis is starting to catch fire. This is by Tyler Durbin on the economic crisis. And what he says, unemployment rates in Greece has hit brand new record levels at 28%. The youth unemployment rate in Greece hit a brand new record of 64.1%. The percent of bad loans in Italy is at an all-time record high. The Italian industrial output declined again in December, and the Italian government is on the verge of collapse, insolvency. Al, when you look at, and we're going to get into some of these other signs, but Al, we saw all of this taking place in 2006 and 2007, and then what happened?
Well, I lived in Europe in 2006 and 2007, all the way to 2009. I was in Spain.
Where were you living?
Spain.
Oh, Spain?
But I'm very familiar. I was just in the left forum at panels about this, speaking with my Greek comrades, and, you know, the perfect scapegoats, right, the Roma, the gypsies in Italy, or the Libyan mm-hmm. refugees that are arriving in Italy, because Libya's pretty close to Italy, to Sicily. And, of course, in Greece, you have coming through Turkey the Afghani refugees. So, you know, they're members of NATO here. So these are victims of the invasions that these countries are partially responsible for. And instead of helping these refugees, they're using them as scapegoats and rounding them up in detention centers. And there's been suicides, and I've heard terrible stories, almost like solitary confinement, you know, what these people have to go through. And, you know, then there's some of them are sent back, you know, to these war zones. I mean, the United States themselves are doing that with children of Central America. It's terrible. And again, the United States is causing these issues. Zelaya in Honduras, most of the immigrant children that enter the United States come from Honduras. When mm-hmm. Zelaya was in power, he was trying to better the economy. He was united with Venezuela. He was making a referendum, and then there was a coup against him, and he was removed from power, a U.S.-backed coup. So when you have leaders, you know, socialist leaders like Zelaya, you know, they're removed from power, and they replace it with a dictatorship to keep the people down in the country war zone. And then when the children try to escape the consequences of U.S. imperialism, let alone the Reagan genocide in the 80s, they're still suffering from that in Central America. But when, you know, the consequences that the United States doesn't want to deal with, they just want to send them back. And I heard as high as, from the World Socialist website, which I know you also read, Stuart, as high
every
as
day.
Figures, right, figures as high as 80% of the immigrant children have their parents in the United States. So when they have to send them back to their family, a lot of them have no family or close family back in their country, no safe place they can go to. And they're rounding these children up as criminals and sending them back. And they're talking about sending more soldiers to protect themselves from immigrant children and orphans. And it's a lot like the mentality of the Zionists in Israel. You know, they see the children as potential
terrorists.
Al,
maybe you can help me out because you brought up something very interesting. How did this situation come up just 2 years before we have the next election where they're trying to get in their Miss Clinton? How did this situation with the immigrant children, I mean, all of a sudden,
Washington.
I mean, you didn't hear anything about this 6 months ago, and now all of a sudden, you know, you hear about, you know, tens of thousands of children. Where did it come from?
Miss Clinton is the most cold-hearted person in Washington.
Right.
You know, let me give you an example of three women in the 70s who were in power and how cold-hearted they were. Three heads of state. Golda Meir in Israel, who let the Israelis die in Munich, you know, at the Olympics, the hostages there. Indira Gandhi, who introduced the nuclear program into India. And Margaret Thatcher, who ruined the British economy and invaded the so-called Falkland Islands, you know, these islands that belong to Argentina, you know, supposedly to go after fascists while protecting Pinochet in her country, who was one of the biggest fascists in South America. But time and time again, whenever a woman has gone into power in our current macho system, she has to prove herself more cold-hearted than men. And a lot of these women happen to be mothers. And just because they're women doesn't mean that they're all of a sudden going to be compassionate.
Right.
I mean, nothing's more sexist than voting for somebody for their sex. And I don't think anything's more racist than voting somebody for their race. Do you think they get the message with Obama, right? That so many people voted for him for his race, and you know what? Look at the disaster of that. He's one of the most unpopular presidents in history. But I think people are going to try to make the same mistake again now with Hillary. You know.
Can I give you my take on this situation with the immigrant children?
Yeah, because Hillary says she wants to send them back.
I'm not disagreeing with you, but my take is, I mean, this thing with what's happening in Marietta is just right on the other side of the freeway from me. I can drive there in my car in 5 minutes. You know,
yep.
But here, Al, what I can see is we have had immigration issues. You know, I shouldn't say we, because I'm not part of it. I don't believe in borders. But, you know, they have had used these immigration issues, and we always see that race always, you know, they always use that race card. But we have so many, Al, we have so many important issues. What has taken place, the atrocities over there in Gaza, and what has taken place with the Israelis, the way they are killing people, what we see taking place in, we're going into what is taking place in Libya right now. A lot of people don't realize that government that we went and invaded, overthrew, is on the verge of collapse again. What is taking place, we're already getting more involvement there in once again in Iraq. And what is taking place in Ukraine, we're almost on the verge of a third world war. And here they put information on the news talking about what is another immigration issue, because they can always, the ruling class can always pull that one out of the bag. And all of a sudden everyone is talking about how they hate who and hate what, instead of focusing on the issues of what these guys are really doing, ready to send our sons and our daughters into another war. But Al, this thing, I think, has been something that has been fabricated, and very interesting, the government has supported it. That's my take on it.
The U.S. government supports dividing and conquering of people by religion, by sect, you know, Sunni Shia, you know, Egypt, Syria. The thing about the Palestinians, though, there are no Shia. All the Muslims in Palestine are Sunni, and they're mm-hmm. united with their Christian brothers. As a matter of fact, in Gaza, they said for the Ramadan prayers that they could come to the churches, and Israel bombed all the mosques. So that was a beautiful act of solidarity that the Christians opened their churches to the Palestinian Muslims. But, you know, one of the few people that actually support the resistance in Gaza are Shia. They're from Syria. They're from Iran. So, you know, this whole division over Shia Sunni, I mean, I told the guy that I know, you know, who lives around here, who's a former member of the Muslim Brotherhood in his country, and I told him, look, you got to stop, you know, dividing yourself on Sunni Shia lines, and because look, Assad's enemy is your enemy too. You guys have the same enemy. You guys need to unite. And George Galloway, you know, the British parliamentarian, gave a speech to a group of Arab students not too far back about the importance of unity as well. I mean, that's why their resources have been able to be robbed for them from the West, because of these divisions that they themselves are responsible for, but of course the West is helping to foment, and then they don't want to take responsibility for it. And even within here in the United States, you know, the division on religious lines, like, oh, we're only spying on American Muslims, don't worry about it. You know, I'm reading right now Greenwald's book, you know, about when he got to meet Snowden and, you know, revealing all these things. And Snowden shows that, no, it wasn't just the Muslim people, it was all of us, the 99%, you could say, you know, that the government was spying on all of us. And if they're going to, I think Ron Paul said this, I don't agree with anything that Ron Paul says, but when he said that when they charged Snowden with treason, he said treason is giving information to the enemy. So this confirms once and for all that the U.S. government considers the American people the enemy, because that was
right.
The first revelation that he showed, right, that the U.S. government was spying on us all. Let alone.
Now, you know, it's something you probably saw me post this on the internet. And, you know, I always post ideas from time to time that I think about on the internet. But when you look at all these conflicts and troubles with economies, you have to realize that banks loan money to help to resolve problems. The biggest problem they can resolve is wars between countries. First of all, they're the instigators on both sides to create the war, and then afterwards they loan the money to these countries so that they can fight each other. And then after they fight each other, you know, whoever the victor is, then the banks basically tell them how they're going to be able to take care of the one that's been vanquished. When they create problems within those economies, they loan them money, and then they loan them money at an interest rate. And then, of course, at the end of the day, when you look at that interest rate, then the entire world owes back $100 trillion. But what I just put out there is say, when it becomes evident that capitalism does not work, the capitalists start a war. They do.
Well, the perfect
they start
example
a war because
that.
You have to realize that war yep. creates more wealth than anything that you can imagine.
Yes. People well, first is guns and then is drugs. And a lot of times they mix the two in their business practices. And I'm talking about the
Yeah,
US
but
government.
You have to realize that
but
wars
IMF,
create trillions of dollars for banks. Trillions.
Right. And the IMF are kind of like the antithesis of what we think is internationalists, but they don't see borders. So the IMF, which are principally run by the United States, but there are also other nations, Europeans, et cetera, that are involved with the International Monetary Fund. But the perfect example of this is that recently there was a couple months back, there was a massacre in Odessa, in the south of Ukraine. Ethnic Russians were burned alive by fascists coming in from the west, from western Ukraine. And, there was very direct correlation between the IMF demands and the attack on Odessa. Because the IMF said, we're not going to send you any money. We're not going to give you the first loan. This is to the new government power. We're not going to give you that first installment unless you take care of the south and the east of your country. So then the very next day, after that demand was made, they went into Odessa and they burned these people alive, and then they claimed that they threw Molotov cocktails on themselves. Then after that happened, the following day, they got their installment. They got rewarded for doing that massacre. So there's a direct correlation between these demands and these acts of real terror from the West. So the IMF works as a mafia. And they'll pay you for making that hit. They'll pay you for showing that you're serious.
Okay. Al, we have approximately another 8 minutes, and I just want to, once again, thank you for joining the program. We do have Al Suarez. He's joining the program today on Left Turn with Stuart Alexander, and our program today, Signs That Capitalism Is Failing Worldwide Since 9/11. Al, you're the first person I even talked about 9/11 since this program started 2 years
yep.
ago. Yeah, so.
And we talked about the Malaysian government last time, too. I forgot to mention that. The Malaysian government is very progressive, and they've brought international arrest warrants for war crimes against Obama and Bush. And they're
right.
going
and
after
we,
the
and
main
we, and we
of
see
revenue,
what's happening with them. They caught in the thick of things, right?
Right.
They're shooting their planes down.
Yes, because that,
two things
that was probably a false flag, too.
Oh, yeah. Hello. Al, there's two things I want to, as you mentioned, I read quite, a lot of what's posted and put out on the Internet by the World Socialist website, and I won't have time to get into everything today because I want you to talk about a little bit about the BRICS banks. But anyway, two things I want to just for our listeners today, the Worldwide Socialist website on, if you go on the Internet, is the financial bubble economy, the financial bubble economy. Now, we heard about the dot-com bubble. We heard all kinds of bubbles that led to the big crash in 2008. There were a lot of bubbles that were created in the economy back in the 20s, which led to the crash in 1929 during the Great Depression. I think the Great Depression is going to pale in comparison to the greater depression that is going to be a recession that's going to be taking place. But if you want to look it up on the website, it'd be the financial bubble economy, because now it's all about money. They're creating money out of nothing and just pumping it into economies around the world. But eventually, there's going to be payback. There's going to be payback. Now,
so the bubble's got to be bursted. That's what.
Oh, it's going to be burst.
Yep.
It's going to be burst.
You got to burst the bubble.
Americans are not prepared, and we need to have this conversation one day. We are not prepared. How are we going to be ready when the big crash? We always think about the big one, the earthquake that's going to take place here in California. Well, we need to be prepared for the big crash that's going to take place in this economy, because it's going to be a situation where people are going to be rushing to the stores. They're going to be rushing to the banks, and the money won't be worth anything. Al, this is where we're going. But anyway, I wanted to speak very briefly because we just have a few minutes. BRICS bank decision highlights growing division among major powers. And again, that's on the World Socialist website. Could you just explain to our listeners a little bit about what the BRICS banks, what they're doing, and how the impact that it can have on the global economies?
Well, like
Please.
I said, they could quite possibly replace one form of capitalism with another.
Exactly.
It might be a little more just type of capitalism. But again, I mean, to me, it's kind of irrelevant because I want an entire change of the global economic system.
Now, what has taken place with this? This is part of what we see that has taken place there in the Ukraine. There is a connection,
yes,
because Russia now has become a major threat to the entire international monetary system, a major threat, because they're leading the efforts with several countries, and those are Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, BRICS.
Mm-hmm.
And this is leading to
Africa was a tragedy, because after Nelson Mandela worked with socialists to help liberate South Africa, he turned the system into a neoliberal system, and that wasn't exactly his fault. But, you know, there's another example of how capitalism, you know, kind of rained on the parade of the end of apartheid in the region.
Right, and so what we're seeing with this formation, as you mentioned, is really essentially, you have to realize the banks are on both sides. They're on the side, they're on one side with the international monetary system, but they're already preparing for the end result of what's going to happen after they form this new institution. Al is just replacing one form of capitalism with another form of capitalism. But at the end of the day, it's not really going to benefit working people. This is actually just going to benefit
the
ruling elite.
There's a lot of leftists that are starting to like Putin and starting to kind of see him as the same, rooting behind him. And look, Putin may be a better leader than Obama, but he's also a capitalist. We have to acknowledge that.
Yeah, he's a very wealthy capitalist. And see,
what we need to
understand is,
but you know, he's got his issues. He invaded Georgia at one time.
Right.
You know, he's made some mistakes.
Right. See, we need to understand when we look at, you know, even Russia today, this government is still, that government is being sustained by the international banks. This government is being sustained by the international banks. We see from world history when leaders and governments don't go with the program, what happens to them, Al?
They are deposed.
Right, including governments.
They're
so,
blackmailed, they're defamed, they're controlled, and if that doesn't work,
assassinated.
There's a coup by external forces against them, like Allende in Chile and all that.
Right, exactly. Al, we just have a couple minutes. I would like for you to have the last word and give our listeners some information how they can be able to contact you. Once again, I want to thank Al Suarez for joining the program, Signs That Capitalism Is Failing Worldwide Since 9/11. Al, could you have the last word and let people know how they can reach you?
Yes, you can find me on Facebook. I'm on Ruthann's page. I'm on Stuart's page, Al Suarez. That's Suarez. And my latest book is The Unfinished Revolution. It can be found on Amazon and CreateSpace. We're going to have at some point in September a book show here in Tampa. And I invite you all to come on down. And for the last word, I mean, what we're talking about here, how to fight capitalism. It has to be revolution. And I'm not afraid to use that word. A lot of people are. But great people like Cornel West and others encourage us to use those words. And I think we should. And I think the time for reform is over. You know, I'm so not afraid to use that word. It's the title of my new book, right, The Unfinished Revolution. And the revolution needs to be finished, and the revolution needs to be constant. We need to be vigilant and keep those changes and implement those changes towards the new society that we're seeking. We need to unite behind that.
Well, Al, I thank you for joining the program once again. And as I mentioned, we're going to have in a future program, we're going to be discussing how people need to be prepared for the economic disasters that's lying ahead of us. And I hope you'll join us on that discussion. Once again, I want to always thank Ruth Ann. She makes this program possible. And also, Al, thanks for joining the program. We look forward to having our listeners join us once again. I believe we're off the air next week, and we'll be on the following week on Left Turn with Stuart Alexander. Thanks again. Have a good night, everyone.
Thank you. Good night. You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Dialogue. I'm Ruthanna Marte-Feo, and our facilitator tonight is Karen Patrick. Hello, Karen.
Hello, Ruthanna. Hello, everybody listening. I'm real excited.
I know this is totally one of your passions. So we're also waiting for Ken to call in, but I think to just start out, the word is pronounced, tell me, Holon?
Yeah, Holon, H-O-L-O-N, Holon,
yeah.
Which is
right.
Greek holos, meaning whole, and the suffix on, which is like a part. So it's a whole and a part.
Right. So it sounds sort of, definitely like a holographic kind of thing, or our cells and different things. I mean, there's different systems that we use all the time, and we don't think of them as that necessarily, but I just wanted to ask, how did you get interested in this, Karen?
Oh, wow. Well, when my university education was in computer science, and I did work in the computer field, and I studied fractal geometry when it came along. It was part of the mathematics program I was in, and also we did system studies, so we're studying, like, you know, when you're doing a program, you're basically looking how a process needs to be done, and you're breaking it down into parts. And so I've always been interested in how things interact or how systems interact. And then I went on to have a family and do other things, but that kind of stuck with me. So I followed different, philosophical thoughts and systems theory thing, and just to see what developed. And I was very interested in the open source development of computer science. In fact, I'm running on a Linux machine right now, where basically it's kind of the open source concept has been adopted in computers to develop big systems with lots of people sharing the workload, basically, and versus like proprietary, like your Apple or your IBM or your PC or whatever. That's more proprietary. That's done by one company, basically. And so this is where all these ideas are being tossed around, but the open source concept has gotten to be very popular in all kinds of other things, like in copyright issues and whatnot. And it's becoming an interesting way to work together. So this is kind of a theory that's developed over, my lifetime of observing systems and how things work, and it's still in development. I'm just going to share some of the history of it and whatnot tonight.
Okay. That was, I was just reading up because I really hadn't heard about this, and so the word was coined back in the 60s.
Yes, Arthur Koestler proposed the word holon in his book *The Ghost in the Machine*, and he also said, really early on, set aside some of the principles of it. In fact, he even had an appendix called *The General Properties of Open Hierarchical Systems*. And what that means is, like, we would usually think of a hierarchy like a pyramid, where the entire structure is made of parts, and you don't define the structure except for, the parts themselves are just parts. They're not necessarily a whole system themselves. in an open hierarchical system or open, this idea is to look at the parts, you know, each part is a whole in of itself, and to realize that, that has a complexity of its own. And one of the problems we have, I think, in organization is that we have, you know, who's in charge syndrome, right? you know, people give a part of themselves to organizations because that's all that's ever asked of them. And so, you know, kind of two parts of the Holon theory is, you know, if it's a sentient or life or biological, and the non-biological systems are kind of treated in a bit of a different way. But it comes from, the base of it comes from how biological systems organize themselves. So it's a philosophy and an idea, basically an idea toolbox, you know. So it's like by looking at something as a Holon, to just, you know, say, it doesn't matter if it's a tree or a person or a bacteria or a committee or a, you know, any kind of organization. You recognizing which parts make it the whole of what it is and what its intentional, you know, energy is, and then also breaking it down into the parts that you recognize themselves are whole on. It's like a little toolbox that you can use kind of a Swiss Army knife of ideas to start parsing out problems. Not just as they are physically, but kind of the energy behind them. And it's useful that way.
Okay. Well, now, so wouldn't, an ideal government of the people, couldn't this be one of the systems that would be a whole on?
Yeah, I mean, you know, talking about the human scale socially or whatever, like just take a human being themselves is a whole on. We have our organs and our spinal system and our circulatory system and all that, and even our physical medicine system specializes in those different systems. But you can't just treat that one part, you know, and when you've got an imbalance somewhere. You've got to think of it's a whole being there, and that's bringing in holistic medicine and whatnot. Well, you scale that up, then from the human scale it becomes what are our relationships, what are our families, what are our communities, and going on up to the government level. That's kind of one of the problems when you scale it up. If you're not careful, you can forget how important the parts are. So we think of, like, this is our government, you know, and it has all these different departments, and they're supposed to be addressing human need, right, or human issues with these committees and organizational structures and, you know, funds and whatnot, departments and stuff. And they become themselves busy within themselves and you know, our how we as human beings interact with this new kind of machine that develops in government, it's not always a good fit, and so we get imbalances. So if we were to look at organizational structures and scale them to the human scale, we can start, I think, making positive changes to how we interact socially. But I think that the individual humans or the need of individual humans gets lost in the needs of the organizations themselves as they kind of organize themselves. So it's a tool to look at those systems a little bit differently than just, you know, here's the president and here's the cabinet, here's the this, and then who's the people? This is the government. This is the people. We're kind of get forgotten in that structure. So this is like I said, it's a toolbox. The Holon study and philosophy is a toolbox of observation.
Okay. So, well, and with back to government or civil government, it would be just we could see maybe it working more as a whole line, very small government on a local level, or in a family.
Yeah,
in a family.
Yeah,
family
that's
with,
a good
with system.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the family, and then the neighborhood, and then you
mm-hmm.
grow. Yeah. Okay, I can see that.
Well, that's a big movement, isn't it, localitarianism? The community I was in before, and I'm just getting started in this community, is to look at the community itself's resources. Community government has gotten really involved in how can we attract stuff from the outside? How can we bring in a big business or bring in a big factory? Or how can we have tourism or something to revitalize their community when they have wonderful tools right there in their community? They just need to become aware of it. And get out of the way, maybe. how people organize themselves.
They're against. Okay, so you're saying like it doesn't have to come from above down.
No, No, you start to look at what is a system like. I got involved in neighborhood activities. We had our local economy there. Our local, you know, was divided by neighborhood. They have a pretty strong neighborhood association there in Olympia, Washington. And so they, you know, kind of created the space for the neighborhood people who were interested in improving their neighborhood to come together and talk about issues. And then, you know, if there was some funding or if there was, you know, some resources that they could share, they could start making improvements within their neighborhood. And that communication also strengthened the part whenever there had to be a city, you know, fix a road or something like that in that neighborhood, they could get really clear feedback from the neighborhood people about how they felt about it, and the project came out a lot more satisfactorily. Mm-hmm. So it's recognizing the organization that's already there and giving it more capacity and giving it more energy, I think is going to be a real key to the, you know, recovery of humanity from these more artificial systems, these more top-down. You know, it's, like I said, it's like a toolbox with only one hammer, or one tool with a hammer, and every problem looks like a nail, you know. Top-down ways of organizing. Right.
Yeah,
I'm going to read go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, the first time I saw that expression, it was just like, well, yes. definitely, because then people make it into a nail. Because we only have
right.
So whatever, it's a nail. But
yeah, and go ahead.
I was just going to ask then how would people just go about understanding the system or using it more?
Well, I've been just quickly, as I was going through looking at material flips, I found a really couple of good resources, and I want to share that real quick.
Okay.
I got some of my notes from an article called A Brief History of Holons by a gentleman by the name of Mark Edwards, and I found a wonderful resource called Integral World, integralworld.net, and this is the concept of the holon kind of comes under integral theory, or seeing how things are connected together. So integralworld.net has a lot of articles about this, and this was A Brief History of Holons. I want to read one paragraph real quick out of that because I just thought it was really excellent. Mr. Mark Edwards states that the development of the human in its personal and social forms is the most complex phenomenon that we know about in the cosmos. To understand this process in any sort of detailed and valid fashion is, to put it mildly, a big task. A gentleman who has worked a lot with the concept of, this is an aside by me, was Ken Wilber. So he talks about Ken Wilber's work. It is my opinion that Ken Wilber's integral theory is the only philosophical philosophical theoretical framework that attempts to present a comprehensive understanding of the complex and multi-layered reality we see about it. One of the most attractive central features of integral theory is it doesn't rely on reductionism to simplify complexity as many branches of science, and then he goes into the different, you know, how a neurologist or a behaviorist or a psychologist or, you know, would reduce all the problems to the thing that they understand, right? And what he was saying is that the transpersonalist reduces to, or more correctly, elevates the human to the world of spirit and finds explanation and analysis of the mystical event. So right away, this is a really comfortable place for people who have are interested in quantum physics and how energy works. It's almost like looking at the underlying structure and energy of things that we see and trying to, you know, give a framework for how do you understand how the energy of something works. And like I said earlier, another where I kind of came into it was Benoit Mandelbrot, who coined the word fractal. So that's another thing that figures in this fractal mathematics. So it's how things are integrated together. Like you could say, one example of a fractal thing in nature is how a tree grows. So you have a seed that falls into the ground, grows into a tree. The next year, the tree will grow twice as big, and the other seeds that it spat out will be exactly that height and exactly that far away from the tree. I mean, you start to look at nature. It's very much operating on some kind of a system of repetition of pattern. And what you can use with the holon is instead of saying, okay, that's a government, or that's an atom, or that's a human, if you look at whatever you're looking at and say, that's a whole on. What is it in its whole intention and what is it in its part? So everything you're looking at gets to be kind of a unit of study. and then you can see, you know, in our systems, when we have an imbalanced governmental system, let's say, where we put, you know, the trickle-down theory that we got from the Reaganomics here, is we're going to give all this money to these guys over here that are businessmen, and they're going to trickle down economic prosperity to us, right? Well, we're seeing the results of that experiment. It's not working really well because of the fact that you've disempowered one group of people and reduced them to just consumers or just, you know, producers. That's all they are. And you've given all these resources over here, and honestly, maybe they don't know what to do with it. Honestly, the only thing they know how to do is accumulate. So they've now pulled more and more energy into that, and you have an imbalance. And now you're only using a tiny part of the majority of the people, and you're overutilizing, you know, the expectations on the other end. In my way of thinking, if everyone is prosperous and engaged and empowered and using their full capacity, the entire system is going to be stronger, and you won't have that too big to fail problem. You know,
okay.
if there's a failure or falling down, then the rest of the system would be able to cover that a lot easier. So that's kind of the idea.
Yeah. So, I mean, people are, well, obviously using these systems without knowing what they're called or without knowing actually all of the potential.
Yeah, potential's an issue, too. It's not just, you know, we are constantly involved in the process of manufacturing scarcity because that's the system we have for trading is money. And money, it goes up, the scarcer something is. So now we have people invested in a planned obsolescence and scarcity and things that, you know, make the value of it go up in dollars, which will benefit some people. But what you've got is now you have weakened everything. If you have products that are shoddy and breaking all the time, that's great for someone who's invested in the monetary part and wants to sell you another broken toaster to break. You know, but if you flip that around and say we're going to value abundance and durability and capacity, we're going to try to get the most use and value out of something that we can. And that's flipping over the paradigm that we have right now that basically is failing. Because I don't think you can go too far away from nature and have it work right, honestly. And we're pretty far away from nature. We have our food come from a box in a store rather than us being really close to land and understanding the cycle of life and the bounty of nature as a factor. Most people couldn't. Tomorrow the economy collapsed, tomorrow what would you do to get food? That would be a total, most people would, like, grab a bunch and hoard. Okay, well, that'll last so long. At some point, you got to go back to nature. You have to go back to how nature works. And so this hole-on, this holarchy or hole-on way of looking at things is really looking at nature, how it creates abundances and it creates diversity and it pulls energy into it and makes it bountiful. And I think it's a way to pull our thoughts out of the what is this exactly thing that we think it is and to think of it in a new way, like a person with capacity. We have a lot of underemployed people, because the system does not know how to access their capacity. And they're not unemployed because they're bad people, and they're not unemployed or underemployed because they can't do anything. It's that they're not asked to do the thing they can do. They're not encouraged to participate with their capacity, their abundance and capacity and learning and knowledge and wisdom that they may have. And that's, to me, a shame, because I think that energy actually is needed. It's actually needed for a full society to work properly. So by looking at each human's capacity, if we can figure out how to engage that capacity, probably because we're going to engage with each other and share, that kind of system will be more holarchic. We'll be looking at each person as a whole person, with capacity, not just a part of something we're trying to do that may or may not work.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, because, well, I mean, it would be quite novel at this point in time to see each person as a whole, complete person with value, because we don't have a lot of that nowadays, it seems.
No, we're not. We're not valuing a lot of things that that nature values. Nature made a lot of people. Maybe she's got a reason. Maybe we have. Nothing in nature is really wasted. And what we've done is we've reduced what humanity means or what a person is as an economic unit in a monetary system, instead of a biological unit. And we are part of nature. We're not separate from it. We are natural beings, and we've gotten way away from that. And we have a scaffolding instead of a building. We have a skeleton of a structure instead of a full robust structure of organization. So, you know, applying the whole on principle is very philosophical in that sense, is to start looking at the whole capacity of humans and how do we engage that, and how do we with each other, with ourselves, you know. This is, the things that I've gone through personally in my life. If I looked at what the world would look at me, you know, basically my basic life situation, I'll share that, is I'm a former caregiver who's injured. So I can't work in that field anymore. So is that what I am? No, I actually still have a lot of knowledge and can use that for advocacy and a lot of other things. I can't go do the hands-on work that I used to do. And that was my economic piece right there. But I'm a very capacitated person in other ways. I can participate in life in other ways. I'm not too far off from being like the disabled people that I helped, and most of that was my daughter who is disabled, and I took care of her for 20 years, and that's why I have injuries. I didn't have the support I needed, or I would have been able to do it longer. But they've monetized all of that. We have one economic theory is that there's two economies, economy A and economy B. Economy A is where money is exchanged and you have jobs and you have, that kind of structure. Economy B is where there's energy put out by a human that is not monetized. So a mother taking care of her kids at home, or someone volunteering to help someone, or someone trades one thing for another. That's economy B. Well, the monetary system has tried to monetize economy B. They've tried to say, your job as a mother taking care of your kids, that's not worth anything. What we want to do is have you be in the workforce. So they've, gone that direction. Instead of honoring them, in some countries, if you take care of children at home, you get a salary. They pay you for that. United States, it's not that way. We haven't made that choice, I guess, in honoring human work. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that's been a peeve of mine for a long time. When you first meet somebody, they say, well, what do you do? And they want to know what you do for money. They don't want to know that you're fighting for peace. They don't want to know. I mean, now, I'm just generalizing. But, I mean, many times, particularly if it's a company, say the company's having some kind of a reception, a cocktail thing that it's required you go to, several company has people there. And this is the first thing. Somebody comes up and, I'm so-and-so, and and what do you do? They don't want to know that you just put in the big community garden for your town. They, although that might fascinate them if you said that, but people are just pretty much used to saying, I'm an IT person, I run this, whatever, instead of talking about what they really, really do, all the abilities that they have that they're working with. That may not be bringing in money, but it's bringing in much more satisfaction and good for the world. So
wouldn't that be an interesting question to ask people? Don't ask them what they do, ask them what they're passionate about.
I ask people what makes their heart sing.
I like that.
Because some people, they can't get their head around that, because it's like, well, I did this because, I went and I had to get the other job, so now I'm working three jobs and blah, blah, blah. But, what makes your heart sing? It's not those three jobs that you're exhausted from, people have come to see, at least a lot of people, that their only value is in what they do to bring in money.
Oh, yeah. I loved your our exercise where we wrote down all the different things that we could do, because in the whole line, the whole part analysis of that is also realizing that I might have a job I do or something or whatever, but I am also a part of other things. I'm a part of a family. I'm a part of my community. We're not just I work at that company or I have that job or I have that profession. When we start to look at ourselves as a whole person and what are we part of, you know, and expand our awareness there, I think we'll be tapping into some stuff that has been bypassed by this overemphasis on money. And then I think the money thing is becoming reductionist because we're almost getting forced to have to look at what else, you know, who else am I, you know, what else is my capacity? What are my resources? Where am I plugged in at the community level to where, you know, I can participate in something. There's a nascent community garden effort going on here in the town. I know the people that are getting that started. They haven't even hardly got their organization started, and they've already had land donated to them, which I thought was terribly exciting because it means that there's a heartbeat here in this community that understands how important food security is, but there hasn't been yet community effort to start to look at that. And that was a strong component of my former community, was to start looking at, food, not lawns, right? There was a gentleman I saw him on Facebook, and he was getting tired of the fact that the sidewalk in front of his store was always chunked up and bad. So he went out and he put a garden in the front of his establishment as a protest. His protest was making a garden, and rather than coming in either helping him with the garden and or fixing the sidewalk, the city came and got a big scraper thing and scraped it up and threw it in the trash. You know, I thought, great.
Wow. Can you imagine? Yeah.
That garden is a protest. I think that's pretty amazing.
Well, you know,
I think it kind of pointed to the issue. Is that here in the middle of the city, you're in a food desert, you know, and it doesn't have to be that way. We could be doing, but we're used to the consumer-grade, you know, corporate chaining of, oh, I must have food, I must go to the store and go in the store and the building, and I must get a brightly colored box, and I must bring that box home and put it in the microwave. This is our orientation to how we sustain our bodies. And that system is having issues right now because of, as the economic thing turns down, the quality of food changes. You buy a box, and all, like you buy a box of cereal, all the grain that makes up the cereal is at the bottom of the box, like still filling up only one-third of the box because it's settled, right? Or my grandma was famous. She's a Depression-era lady. So she was famous for pointing out where they cut back on portions and raise the price at the same time. So she would turn over yogurt containers and juice bottles, and she'd show the false bottoms where the bottom points up into the bottle, and that takes up some of the fluid measure. Or
right.
You don't get a you think you're getting a pound of coffee, but it's like 14 ounces instead of 16 ounces. You know,
it's about 13 ounces now or something. The indentation in the bottom. That's funny because I was showing somebody the other day because I buy spring water, and I was, you know, loading up, and she was going to help, and she said, oh, look, and I said, no, because that's only like 3.5 quarts or whatever. It's not a gallon. I said, look, and I turned it upside down, and there was this whole big indentation, you know, in the jug. Just like some wine has that.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah,
and
then the other part of it is the fillers they put in it. They put fillers in it, and if they put a filler into a product, they're taking the grain or the nutrition out of it.
Oh I don't. I do buy pasta, and I'm trying to think. I'll buy some condiments, but I don't buy anything out of those boxes and things. And
yeah.
I was so thrilled myself in this little place where I live because there is no farmer's market. But I did find, somebody just told me the other day, and I was like, oh, my God. And he took me there to this place where he took me by it, where this older guy has gardens. And he also, this is in town, but I guess he has several gardens in the country. And so during the week he sells things. He has a sign out front, you know, just a hand, you know, zucchinis, tomatoes, onions, you know, this kind of thing. But I am going to go there because I'm so thrilled that somebody's actually doing some of that. So maybe I can get, like, more than I could get myself, grow, whatever. And I want to see what he's doing. But sometimes you have to search these things out. And, you know, it may not be organic, but it's going to have a lot less pesticides than what I buy in the grocery store, as a rule.
Chemicals that they use so they could transport it a long distance or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And here's a man who's expanded his human capacity. You know, he could have just done like everyone else. And he looked at the situation and expanded his capacity to where not only is he provided for himself, but he's actually able to share and expand into the community and share what he's done.
Right. And it allows him to also, he has some helpers that, you know, he pays. And, I mean, so it's not a big concern. You know, it's not some big corporation, but it's just like a local whatever. And and he actually, they told me, I believe he's in his early 80s. And
that older generation, you know, they went through the Depression and went through the war years when everyone had like a victory garden and all that. You know, my grandmother was like that. They have a lot of wisdom to share about, you know, how do you live in, you know, closer to when we were, you know, half the country was farmers, and also how they had to deal with scarcity issues. You know, that wisdom, that inherent wisdom, isn't that interesting? Because generally our older people, we do not honor our elder people. We don't honor them. We don't listen to them much. We don't, you know, it's like a... I made the personal choice to try my best to get to know my older relatives and really listen to them, and I was really blessed to get... I only had one grandmother that survived when, you know, I was born. All the others had perished, you know, they had deceased. And what a treasure. She kind of lived next door, and I got to really have long conversations with her and talk to her about all the different things that she lived through and learn. And by the way, my grandmother and Ken's are the same one. We're first cousins, actually. So he knows Rio. So yeah, there's this inherent wisdom, and yet here if you looked at older people, you know, as in the consumeristic economic thing, they're seniors, they're retired, and they're non-workers. So what do? Oh, I'm retired. Oh, okay, well, I'll go to the next person. You know what I mean? There's this, if you look at them through those consumer spectacles or whatever, they don't have anything to offer, and yet maybe not all of them. Maybe some of them are sick and tired and just, you know, want to keep to themselves, but. Oh, there's quite a few that have wisdom that is very useful. Yeah. Wisdom, hey, there's a commodity.
Really?
Wisdom.
Really? Yeah. That's what I've talked to a few people who've worked in nursing homes, and they, because I've thought, well, I could see the ups, but I could see the depression there too, but they've learned so much. They value people, but you're right. In our particular society, age is not really valued that much. It seems like other cultures do, but just why American really doesn't seem to do it as much. And that's
because of the economic judgment. You know, Grandpa can't use a computer, so what does he know?
Yeah. That could be that's true, the economics, because there again Madison Avenue has decreed and people are watching so much TV they believe what they see, and so you know you have to have all these new things and do this and this and this and this, and there's no room then for that wisdom that Grandpa could be passing on to us. I like it when communities pair up children and older people, so it's sort of like an adopted grandparent or something. I don't know what they call that, but there's different organizations that do that. So the older people benefit from all this energy and enthusiasm, and the youngsters benefit from all this wisdom. So
yeah, and yes, and also to, you know, the it, all of us at all different ages, at all different socioeconomic levels, have something to offer. We're just putting it through a really narrow aperture. We're putting it through a consumerism aperture. And I actually think that we do have a very robust backlash to that. There's another terminology is the maker community. I recently went to an event where all the people who made things, they called it Make It Olympia. Everybody who made the hats and gloves, and some people made, you know, made things to make things with, you know, which was kind of cool. That's becoming a really robust movement as well, to find out how are things made, and how, and then how can we improve it. And in weirdly enough, our technology is even going in that direction, because we now have, I don't think we have to throw out technology per se, but there's this movement in technology, 3D printers, where you can now have an idea, express it on your screen in a 3D format, and then the printer will actually print the new item or whatever it is.
Right.
I think this hands-on thing is going to get to be really popular again, and I think it's going to unlock a little bit of that stored-up energy that we have in people who've been, when the tools finally get to accessible to us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Think about what happens when we all got computers, or when we all got our cell phones, or we all got graphic software, we all got word processors. That stuff used to be hard to come by. The press, or just the news media used to be all, you know, we had three channels at one point, three television channels. We still have only six media corporations. You know, that is kind of a problem. But the citizen journalism thing where people, their blog, they're not waiting to for someone in the media to tell us. I literally had someone say, you should not view that as a problem until an expert says it's a problem. You know, and I went, really? I said, it's like, I won't be holding my breath for that, because I saw this issue and I thought it should be addressed, and just because I don't have a PhD doesn't mean I don't think it's an issue. I'm a citizen. I have a right to say, wow, that's an issue, and to see what could be done about it, you know. So that's that flipping into the whole-on thinking, or the holarchic thinking mode, is to say, hey, I can do something. I don't have to wait. I don't know how to fix this problem in the community or address it or in my life, but I don't have to sit around and wait for someone to fix it. What can I do?
Exactly.
And then you start doing that wonderful thing we did, assessing what you know how to do and talking to other people, what do they know how to do? And discussing that, you might immediately find, oh, well, I can do this for you if you do this for me. It's just flipping the scale. Not waiting for the top-down, you know, somewhere at the UN resolution that, you know, people are going to have gardens. You know, don't hold your breath on that. Hey, here's some people. There's some people out there with green thumbs, and they'll give you a seeds, or they'll show you how to grow something.
Exactly. Yeah, you don't have to wait for that expert from on high to come to your neighborhood and teach you, your neighbor, how to do this. So, but it is like you say, you know, like assess your own abilities, like we were doing the other day, like make these lists of your own capabilities, you know, like, and what have you done, you know, maybe it was just when you were small, even maybe you were sketching out some ideas, and who knows, maybe you're still sketch, maybe you could try take that up again, but it's just like your people skills, this, I mean, there's such a wide variety, and then, get some of your friends and neighbors to do this too. And, you know, I think that people are just amazed when they see all the things that they actually can do, their abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, yeah. And what they can do together without an official committee. And I did run into that when I was working on a community project. I ran into two types of people. People who said, hey, let's see what we can do. I don't know how to do this, but we'll learn how. It was fun writing when our group actually did decide to incorporate I was working on an artesian well project. We actually did decide to become an organization. We had to sit and write, you know, steering committee roles and things like that, but we kept it really, really light. I was with a great group of people that, hey, we just need enough structure to be able to do certain things. But you know, getting a bunch of us together to write our steering committee rules was kind of fun, because you could tell we were not exactly professionals. But it was good, and we did it. We got through it, and we did it. And we did all kinds of things we didn't think we could do. And it actually was accomplished, and it's actually quite a successful project. And I can tell you, it was really grassroots. And a lot of it had to do with just catching the imagination of the community, and people came out of the woodwork to do all kinds of things. Because they say, hey, I could do this. You know, I could donate, one group had a show. They had a show at a local venue, and they donated money for us, and that was part of what we could. We were very low budget, so we were, like, really surprised. They actually thought we were worthwhile. So it's changing the scale. That's the key. Using the whole idea, it's changing the scale. It's to say, if I see a need, I am a whole being that can address it. I have a whole community. There's nothing missing. There's nothing that we need except to start with who we are. And then those other, there's an energy piece to this. There's the idea that if we set our intention and we set our intention together, because we can either set our energy and our intention to gripe about the problem and it's never going to be resolved. Or we can set our intention to say, hey, we're going to do this. This is what we're going to do. And be, you know, really willing to hear other people out and what that intention would be. And you'd be surprised
if we're doing. Well, and part of that, though, isn't it then being open enough and becoming aware, like looking around, seeing what needs to be done and, you know, what can I get in there, or do I know somebody who could maybe do that I could talk to and tell them, hey, look, you know, I'm not telling you to do that, but, you know, this really needs to be done. I think, getting to know ourselves again and other people, though. Doing the hermit thing is really not going to be beneficial for ourselves or for anyone else. We need, and even if you're shy, so you can start talking to people. Just make it, you know, very simple. And you don't have to, you know, just go in all guns blazing, but just start to get to know your neighbors. Start
to talk to people. And you'll find angry people. There's a lot of angry people. There's a lot of people that are going to say it can't be done. There are going to be people that said, oh, we tried this and this happened. There's fantastic failures out there. And I think part of that is just you've talked many times about the, consciousness that's coming in. It's kind of accelerating some things, but it's also kind of deconstructing some things. We're finding we really don't want to do it the old way. So then there's a lot of kerfuffling that goes on with people who try to continue to do it the old way, or they're still upset about the problem, or they're upset at other people. You know, maybe just go to the other side of that room and talk to somebody else for a while. I don't know what to do until someone's tired of being mad.
No, don't just keep yourself surrounded by the naysayers, because that's hard. That's very hard, no matter how optimistic and how, you know, gung-ho you are. If you just have those kind of people around you all the time, you've got to find other people on the same vibrational level.
And that's what we probably haven't done. I think people have been, when you said being by yourself, I think some of the fluctuation of negativity that's going on is our human system is transitioning. It makes you want to kind of cocoon sometimes, because it's when something's healing, sometimes it hurts, right?
Mm-hmm.
Humanity might be healing, but it's hurting until it does. You know, I broke my arm once, and it hurt like heck while it was healing. So it does make you want to cocoon. Some of us are really coming to the conclusions like this intuitively. It's like they're really working intuition. They're really working maybe metaphysical ideas. They're meditating. This is where this is. And the impetus to want to change things is coming from, and then they reach out from that perspective and they run into, the old paradigm of what people think about a materialistic way of looking at things and hierarchistic or political or religious ways, and they get beat down, you know. Go find your people. I recently did that. I found my people.
Exactly.
My metaphysical people, and it's making a big difference in my life.
Yeah.
And that was the second part that we did when you made us... Well, we had to go talk to people.
That energy out. Because you will be drawing people then who have your vibrational level to you. That's the thing. If you just, I mean, and everybody, of course, wants to cocoon for a few hours. Sometimes you've got to get away, whatever. But, you know, don't burrow down because, you know, you start getting yourself together again, start sending that energy out, and those people will come. Ways will be made. It's amazing how when we put it out, really put it out, things happen. But there again, it takes maybe different eyes or open eyes anyway to see where there's needs. I go to there's a secondhand place here in town, and it's part of an organization that is government funded for all kinds of things. They have after school programs. I think there's seniors and migrant children and different kinds of things. And attached to it is this secondhand store where everything is El Cheapo. And I do donate things there. And I took some more in today, and I hadn't been there for a while. And I was like, wow, this looks different. Well, it turned out that some local man had donated a bunch of shelving, like store shelving. And I don't know who he is, so I don't know if he still has a store and just got new shelving or if he was getting rid, whatever. But, you know, there was no committee, there was nothing. He just went and said, I've got this stuff, and they said, yay, and there it is. So, he could have just junked it. It's metal. He could have sold it for, you know, a few cents, whatever, on the pound, but he brought it to a place that could use it. And, you know, I mean, this is it. Just keep your eyes open, because things you have or the talents you have, there's a place that really needs that. So, and, you know, you might start out doing something or say, well, I could do this, and you find out, wow, I'm going to be learning a lot because I don't know all the answers. But I'm going to depend on these other people, too, to help me and to point me in the right direction. So, you know, there again, I'm big on learning and learning as we go. So, you know, never think that you have to have all the answers before you begin a project. That's not the case. You know, if you're putting a lot of money into something, yes, you want to know quite a bit about it before you invest your money. But as far as, you know, jump in. I mean, there's been so many things that I'm actually pretty good at now that if I would have waited or said, oh, golly, I really don't know, then I never would have done them, and I never would have had good results, maybe a couple of, like, not so good, but overall more good than not, and met so many people, you know? You have to take a few chances. You've got to like there's some kind of a saying I've seen, and I all it boils down to is that the wings sprout or open after the person or the bird takes the leap. I firmly believe that it's you just get that little running start and you jump off that cliff.
And I think the self-discovery process is so important, because I think we do have in the past gotten shoved into, I am that title or I am that role. And if you look at yourself as a whole, you know, as a whole being of, you know, take that time and reflect and find out who you are, then you'll be able to do stuff like a lot of things we fall into for work is, you know, to get the money or to get the paycheck, and might not be something that you really had your heart into at all.
Absolutely.
Sometimes people get to the point where they just cannot do the thing that they used to do for money, and they have better find some other aspect of themselves in a different way. Or, you know, you just feel like you're not a person. I'm not a person. I'm useless again. And there's a lot of depression that goes along with when you can't do work that you used to do. Then find another part of yourself. if you find another part of yourself and participate in that area for a while, I think it's good. And this is when you look at yourself as all of the parts of you, all of your experiences that you had. The whole unit of life experience is the human, right? And then when all whole people or people who are whole are connecting together, the potential, the energy potential is so much more than if I just, you know, half-hearted. That's why I don't know how does our economic systems run when we have so many people unhappy with their jobs because they're only able to give a part of themselves. Is it any wonder the customer service is down, production is down? Because people are only allowed to put a small percentage of who they are into their job, into that corporate structure or whatever. It's a half-hearted attempt, you know?
It's something they're not interested in the first place, many of them. I mean, they take the job because they need the money. But then the kicker is when they get downsized, and then they are in that, you were talking about depression. I mean, that's total depression for them because they thought that that was the only value they had as a worker doing X and making X money, and now they have no job, so they're nothing. And, I mean, some people have come out of that like, wow, they found their true calling because they worked, find it. And others just keep that depressed mode going because our society has taught them that's where their value is.
Just being a part of something that then got destroyed, and now what are you?
Exactly.
If you're a whole unit of energy and parts of the creator or whatever, that's a completely different perspective to work from than, oh, I was a manager and then they downsized me, now what am I? You know, if you invested too much in your title or your role, or, hey, I went through the empty nesting, right? I was mom, and then all my kids grew up and went on their way, and I better find something else inside of me besides mom, which is a great role. But if you do a good job, they're out and about and doing things. You work yourself out of a job, you know.
Right.
So,
hopefully they don't come back with the whole bunch of kids to live off of you now.
Oh, the boomerang, the boomerang thing. Well, then you get, I've been fortunate that way. I've kind of stayed temporarily in between things, and even I've done that. So redefining your role, that would be a different role, wouldn't it? If they came back, you couldn't treat them like they were little children anymore. You would have to redefine your role. You would have to find each other as adults. So, this is an important concept, is that each human, every human being is a whole expression of source, right? A whole expression of creation in and of themselves. They are not, we should not reduce people down to, you're just a, that's a tough one. Anytime that person is just a, when I hear just that's reductionism and it's unfair.
It's
unhelpful. Or even women used to say, I'm just a housewife. Wow.
I was going to say that one of the things that, there again, Madison Avenue with movies and books has done to people, I hate it when people say that they're looking for their quote-unquote soulmate because they want to be a whole person. And it's just like, what the fuck is wrong with you? You know? I'm sorry. It's like, you are a whole person. You don't need somebody to complete you. And I've had people tell me that, you know, that they can't wait. They're looking for their other half or whatever. And it's like, my goodness, you know, you are whole. Maybe you need to work on that a little bit.
When you meet somebody, that relationship would be a whole on of itself. And from that relationship, you might have a household mate or you might have a homemade, and that's a whole on of itself. It has whole parts of it. You want to bring two whole people together.
So you can have a lot of these, but, I mean, to begin with, you are whole, and this person is whole. So together you make another whole. And with your community and your family, you have all these different whole-ons going on. But it starts with I don't know, it starts with an atom somewhere. It starts with your own cells. It starts with you being a whole on. And then you go on. But you don't, that need to have something, you know, the that whole thing, and what do? Oh, I'm just a. And like
yikes.
You were saying, I mean, that is so demeaning, and that is so self-demeaning when you're saying it about yourself. And if you're saying about somebody else, well, he's just a, like, whoa. No, that might be a small part of what the person does. They may do that for money, but they're a whole other, you know, individual. They have loves and hates and things they're good at, things they're not so good at, all these ideas they have. They're not just an office worker. They have all these other aspects. So all of these fractals, right? All of
yeah.
these pieces, the parts. So
I used to work in a clinic with a doctor that was really grumpy. Nobody got along with him. And then I found out he did greyhound rescue. And I thought that was, we talked all about his greyhounds and you know, all these things about the racing industry. And I learned a lot from this guy, but you would never expect this grumpy old man to be, you know, rescuing dogs, you know. And it was awesome.
Yeah. That's it. I mean, we don't know what these people are doing when they're not at work with us. I mean, unless they tell us. But, I mean, you know, we tend to jump and assume, I think, a lot. Before we really know what we're assuming or jumping into. What would you
yeah.
say, Karen, then, if somebody wants to, I mean, besides already being involved in this even unknowingly, how could people get more, become more aware and so that they would do things more focused?
If they were interested in this, just look it up on Wikipedia. Learn a little bit about the idea of it, and it's run along and become a whole philosophy with a lot of academic energy behind it. So it's kind of a big deal now, a lot of discussion about it. But just, you know, kind of read up on it, see what it, you know, philosophically what it looks like for them. But to, you know, we have done a wonderful two exercises that where we sat and wrote our own, you know, what can we do or who we are, what do we think kind of list, and then go and engage with other people. The concept is to step back and see if there's new tools of ways of thinking. I think I know for me, I can get into habits of thinking that just kind of dead end. You know, my I only have my ideas and they're based on emotional issues and things that I couldn't resolve within myself. And so when I've gotten to those dead ends, it's like, you know what, I don't have enough information here. I need a new way of looking at this situation. So, you know, the thing that I take away from Holons or anything is to get new tools of the mind. You know, study how you think. Study how you observe things and how you perceive things. Just think about it for yourself. Like, you know, I keep getting in the same rut. You know, why do I always think of this thing the same way? This would be a good question. What could I think about that would, how could I look at this? What observation point can I have that would make this thing the way I want it to, or positive for me, or looking at it from another perspective? That's how I got into interest in the whole on idea, and other ideas as well. Is, you know, Einstein was, you know, everyone considers a pretty smart guy. And he said, we can't resolve the problems from the same mindset that it took to create the problem.
Exactly.
So I think we're kind of in a season where we have to shake up our just how we think and how we observe problems.
Yeah.
And if we've tried it the same old way and it's not working, we might want to look at another way to do it.
Yeah, that's saying. I remember the first time I heard it, I was just like, oh my God. A man was talking about. Oh, he was. He spoke at AA meetings around, and he was explaining to us about that. And he said, you know that saying, if you keep doing what you've been doing, you're going to keep getting, you know, the same results. And
yeah.
It's like, that's a definition of insanity, like just doing and expecting
yeah.
different results. It's like, well, no, if I'm not getting what I want doing it this way, let me shake this up a little bit. And, you know, the miraculous thing, I think, about that is those of us who actually you know, try to tune into the spiritual aspects and all, we can ask our higher self to help us because...
Oh, definitely.
Oh, my goodness. Our higher self is just waiting.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. You've got like 20 seconds.
Oh, good. Oh, okay. Well, that's really great that you said that because I have been working with something called automatic writing, which is, you know, kind of flow of consciousness. And I came up with the word integral, which is a word that was used in that website, as enter grace and gratitude. You give yourself grace for your mistakes and you're grateful for the things that are working and are positive. So the opposite of coming apart in pieces and compartmentalization of problems is integration, enter grace and gratitude. That is something I've been working with.
Good words, yeah. Integration of gratitude. That's it. And remember the interconnectedness because gratitude, very important. We will not be here next week, but we will be back in 2 weeks. So, Karen, thank you so much. This is fascinating. I can see how you got hooked.
yes.
Isn't it truly?
Hooked on hold on. Bye, everybody.
Thank you.